We come now to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Duncan Webb.
Kia ora, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, the government's efforts to secure our recovery have been reflected in the latest measure of the country's economic health. Statistics New Zealand reported last week that GDP rose by 1.6% for the March 2021 quarter, exceeding the expectations of even the most optimistic commentators. New Zealanders' confidence in the recovery saw a boost in retail spending, particularly on big-ticket household items, hospitality and holiday accommodation. Importantly, activity in the construction sector returned to near record levels, while business investment in plant and machinery jumped by over 15%. The higher COVID-19 alert levels during the quarter only had a limited impact on the economy thanks to the quick response which provided cash flow and confidence. Mr. Speaker, quarterly activity in March has now exceeded the December 2019 quarter pre-pandemic level. Nevertheless, the data does show the volatility that New Zealand has to deal with during the pandemic. This 1.6% increase followed a 1% decline in the December quarter and a record 14.1% increase in the September quarter.
Supplementary, how does New Zealand's economic performance compare with other countries?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this result is further evidence that our public health strategy of going hard and early to beat COVID was also the correct response for the economy. Getting our economy back up and running, either without COVID in the community, has meant households and businesses can move about and operate more freely than in many other countries. The New Zealand economy was 2.4% above where it was in the March quarter last year, outperforming the countries we compare ourselves with. In the same period, Australia rose by 1.1%, the United States by 0.4%, Canada by 0.3%, while Japan declined by 1.5%, and the United Kingdom by 6.1%. The global economy is recovering, Mr. Speaker, but the ongoing and uneven impact of COVID-19 means that the environment will remain volatile for some time.
What reactions has he seen to the GDP report?
Mr. Speaker, we're doing it in real time here, but previously the ANZ economist called the result eye-popping and noted that, quote, the rise in GDP confirms that New Zealand has seen a spectacular economic recovery. That sentiment was reflected in other commentaries. Kiwibank said the report was stronger than expected pretty much across the board and the economy has confidently returned to pre-COVID levels. And as the ASB noted, the sheer unexpected strength of quarter one GDP growth adds to the weight of evidence that the New Zealand economy is on very firm footing despite the global pandemic. Mr. Speaker, this government's economic recovery plan is working. We are supporting businesses and workers to succeed despite the uncertainty of COVID-19 and the naysayers on the other side of the House.
Question number two, David Seymour.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And on behalf of ACT, I'd like to congratulate you on becoming the father of the House. My question is to the Prime Minister.
I'm tempted to say grandson or something, but just keep going.
All righty, Grandad. He started it. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement that, quote, a large number of those buyers of those vehicles are not using them for the legitimate use, end quote?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by the point I was making, even though I will absolutely say that I think I could have been clearer in the way I made it. As a cabinet, we gave full consideration to the option of creating a carve-out for those vehicles for which there currently aren't equivalent low-emission alternative options, where those vehicles were, for instance, used for business or work purposes. As a member, and I know many in this House will appreciate, drawing such a distinction does raise issues of fairness, consistency and implementation. I would make the point to the member that almost two-thirds of the utes sold in New Zealand last year would not be covered by this policy as they were part of the existing second-hand market. We also expect new models to become available over time.
Supplementary. So as the fee-bait policy was finalised with that advice, will people who are using a ute for their legitimate use still have to pay tax under fee-bait?
Mr. Speaker, first I'd like to clarify that actually it was not the advice of officials that we have a carve-out. In fact, their view was that we should not. That did not stop Cabinet having a discussion over the fact that there, for many, are not an alternative for a ute, which is used for business purposes for many, that there is not an alternative currently, no emissions vehicle on the market. So that's why we had that discussion. But ultimately, Mr. Speaker, as I've said in my primary answer, there were issues around how you would implement such a carve-out. So ultimately the decision was taken to have a much more straightforward scheme, recognising which was coming on stream. And the point I make to the member, no one who currently owns a ute is affected by this policy. This is for new and imported vehicles rather than those that are existing and in the country and in the second-hand market. A point that I note is not being clearly made by all members in this House.
Supplementary. Could those people buying utes for quote-unquote legitimate uses avoid the tax by purchasing an electric ute from Toyota? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, at present, those who are bringing in electric vehicles into the market within the next 12 to 24 months include LDV. Toyota have themselves said, quote, they hope to have a Hilux hybrid enter the market before the end of next year. That statement was made by the Toyota New Zealand CEO on the 22nd of April 2020. And I would say again to the member, the vast majority of utes purchased by New Zealanders are from within the second-hand market, which is not affected. And this policy that we've applied does cover incentives or no fees for low and hybrid vehicles, not just EVs.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you to the Prime Minister. Is it the Prime Minister's job to tell Kiwis whether or not their vehicle choices are legitimate?
Mr. Speaker, the member, if she listened to my first answer, would have heard me clarify that actually drawing those distinctions are incredibly difficult. So creating a carve-out, although it was considered by Cabinet, was just not something that we felt we could do fairly. I would say to the member that given Stuart Smith says I'm against subsidies for EVs, Michael Woodhouse says National supports introducing financial incentives for EVs, Chris Bishop says National is the party for EVs. Oh. Mark Mitchell says he would incentivise them, and Todd Muller says he's broadly supportive. I personally would be interested in what National's policy is on this issue.
Supplementary question.
Does she view driving?
Order, order. The extra questions are mitigated by the fact that laughter came from both sides.
Supplementary. Does she view driving a seven-seater people mover like the Mazda CX-9 as illegitimate? If not, why is she putting a tax on them?
Mr. Speaker, again, this is also about trying to make sure that we are incentivising and discounting low emissions, not just EV, but low emissions options. We know from research that placing incentives at the point of sale supports those who otherwise may not have the ability to ultimately purchase a vehicle which would be cheaper over the lifetime cost. A Toyota Estima 7-seater produces a $670 discount for a used vehicle. A Toyota Prius V7 seater has a $1,310 discount. A Nissan 7-seater has a $3,450 discount. They're all used vehicles. In fact, 8 out of 10 of New Zealand's most popular used vehicles either have no fee or attract an incentive or a discount.
Mentoring. Has the Prime Minister driven an electric ute from Toyota? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, as I have already said, LDV are bringing the electric vehicles. Toyota themselves have acknowledged that they are bringing in a hybrid. Again, Mr. Speaker, no one here is saying, and this is the very reason we've discussed the carve-out issue, that there currently is that immediate alternative. However, As has been said by Drive Electric, taken together, the emission standards and consumer incentive plus puts New Zealand on the map for electric vehicle manufacturers. We're telling them New Zealand is a serious market for electric vehicles and we want that supply. We're looking forward to them bringing in new ranges and models. New Zealand, Mr. Speaker, may have otherwise suffered from manufacturers not necessarily supplying New Zealand with alternatives if we did not have clean car standards and incentives.
Supplementary. Will it be a legitimate use for a Toyota electric ute to drive it on the bike bridge that the government announced last week? And if not, why not?
Order.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
Now, I brought the question out because it involves irony. The member knows that. The member knows it's out of order. If he's going to really argue that it doesn't, he's going to have to make a pretty good argument.
Mr. Speaker, there's a perfectly legitimate line of questioning about the legitimacy of different use of vehicles. The Prime Minister has tried to tell New Zealanders what that is, and people want answers about what it might be. There's also a perfectly legitimate line of questioning about the utility to be derived from the government's announcement of a bike bridge. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask what the scope of that bridge is. Now, I'm glad that you find it entertaining, Mr. Speaker, but people at home want answers to these serious questions.
That's right. The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, does the Prime Minister think it is possible for New Zealand to reach its climate change commitments, including those signed up to in Paris, by changing absolutely nothing about our vehicle fleet?
Mr. Speaker, no. In fact, the majority of New Zealanders, when surveyed, support initiatives in this area because, unlike the member asking the question, they do not believe that we can sit back while the world continues to move and change around us without getting in front of this issue. We are behind the rest of the world when it comes to the uptake of electric vehicles, and a good reason for that is because the price point at the point of sale is high. This is one way we can support New Zealanders, and it will reduce the lifetime cost of their vehicle. That member wants them to pay more at the pump instead.
Supplementary. If Toyota electric utes did exist, would it be legitimate to use them on the bridge recently announced by the government?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Supplementary. If Toyota electric utes did exist and they were able to be driven on that bridge, would that help raise the benefit cost ratio for the bridge from the measly 0.4 reported in the Herald on Friday?
Mr. Speaker, look, on the one hand, I do want to applaud the ACT Party for finally agreeing that actually climate change exists. That's a vast improvement on where you were 10 years ago. I sat in this House when Rodney Hyde instigated a select committee to inquire into the existence of climate change. So look, congratulations for moving on some way. But the member, at least if he wants to acknowledge that climate change exists, perhaps now is the time to actually support some initiatives that will do something about it.
Supplementary. Is this line of questioning getting under the Prime Minister's skin?
Further supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I ask the Prime Minister, if Toyota electric utes did exist and could be driven on the bridge, and it would make the bridge viable under benefit cost ratio, what would be the government's plan for disposing of all those thousands of toxic EV batteries?
Mr. Speaker, so the member unfortunately believes that we as a nation will be better off instead becoming the dumping ground for all of those high emissions vehicles that other countries are currently banning. No one in New Zealand, I would have thought, would think that is a good idea unless we move to a combination of clean car standards and incentives. We will be the dumping ground of the rest of the world. I also note that countries that he likes to replicate, the likes of Singapore, has a clean car incentive, such as the one that New Zealand is proposing.
Supplementary. Could the Prime Minister please now answer my previous question? What is New Zealand's plan for disposing of EV batteries? It's a serious question.
Well, you'll be, Mr. Speaker, I'll be forgiven for not thinking it was a serious question.
A point of order, Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, the members had a fair go, but it's very hard to see how that question stems at all from the primary question.
I think, unfortunately, because the Prime Minister was fairly fast to answer the previous question when I would have probably ruled it out, by her answer, she made the subject area broad enough for Mr. Seymour to ask his question. Just.
Mr. Speaker, I could be forgiven for not taking the member's question as seriously as he intended for the nature in which he asked it. But when it comes to the issue of batteries, these, of course, are things that the likes of MFE continue to work through. But I would still caution the member around the idea that somehow that is a reason for us to continue, as I've said, to be the dumping ground of vehicles that many, many other countries we import from are banning.
Supplementary. The Honourable David Parker.
Is the Prime Minister aware that the lead acid batteries in cars and trucks are amongst the most recycled item on the planet? And is she as confident as the Minister of the Environment that such systems will also be used in the future for lithium-ion batteries?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Question number three, Theresa Ngobi.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Social Development and Employment, what reports has she seen regarding the number of people receiving a main benefit?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
The monthly benefit update for May shows a further decrease in the number of people receiving a main benefit. As of the 31st of May, there were 357,591 people receiving a main benefit, a fall of 3,087 from April 2021. Overall, the number of people receiving a main benefit has fallen 32,010 since the end of January. 20,484 of these people moved off the job seeker work ready benefit. Mr. Speaker, it is clear that the government's quick action in combating COVID-19 has lessened the expected economic impact and kept people in jobs. We're not out of the woods yet, but the signs are very promising.
Supplementary, what is the government doing to get people work ready and offer main benefit?
Mr. Speaker, in the March quarter, we saw a record number of people cancel their benefit and move into work. This trend continued in May 2021 with a further 10,881 people leaving a main benefit and moving into work. The government has invested heavily in programs that focus on upskilling people and getting them ready for work. Mana and Mahi, He Pautama Rangatahi, Flexi Wage and Apprenticeship Boost have been particularly successful in getting people ready for the jobs on offer in the labour market. Budget 2021 continues this work by investing a further $99 million over 2 years to bolster MSD's frontline work-focused services to get people back into work.
What is the government doing to get long-term job seekers into work?
Mr. Speaker, in the March quarter, 4,137 people who had been receiving a benefit for longer than a year exited the Job Seeker Work Ready benefit into employment. Most people on a benefit want to work, but many have barriers to employment. The role of MSD is to find ways to overcome these barriers, and as the numbers show, we are having some success. But we also have programs in place to incentivise employers in taking a chance on those who are disadvantaged in the labour market. One such program is FlexiWage, which has placed 3,582 people who are at risk of long-term benefit dependency into work since February 2021. 97% of these placements have not returned to benefit.
Question number four, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly the government's efforts to secure our recovery, which have been reflected and GDP increasing 1.6% in the first 3 months of 2021. Overall, the economy was 2.4% above where it was in the March quarter last year, outperforming the countries we compare ourselves to, such as Australia, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom and Japan. While there is a lot of uncertainty on how COVID-19 will affect different parts of the global economy, our recovery plan has kept people in jobs, with unemployment in the March quarter at 4.7%, and supported businesses with ongoing targeted stimulus. The government will keep its focus on keeping New Zealanders safe from COVID-19, accelerating our recovery, and making progress on long-standing issues such as climate change, housing and child wellbeing.
Very good.
Does she think New Zealanders would have expected her government to have delivered more than just five extra acute mental health beds in the 2 years since she announced $1.9 billion for mental health?
Mr. Speaker, on our mental health program, we were very clear from the outset that we wanted to focus on trying to support those New Zealanders who find themselves in our mental health system and often at the very acute end without necessarily having had support through primary mental health services. So we have been building those primary mental health services. 1.4 million New Zealanders are now enrolled in primary health care with access to mental health and addiction services. They're offering 10,000 sessions per month. Those are sessions that did not exist before. Take that alongside funding for Youthline, for our youth health services, the rollout of health services in schools, mana ake, and counselling services in schools. We are building the front end of mental health. When it comes to capital and bed space, the member will know well the time that takes. I understand in 2015, Minister Little, that the one program or project that National funded took over 5 years to deliver. We want to do things more quickly than that, but building buildings and creating bed space does take longer.
Why does it take 2 years just to put in five extra acute mental health beds?
Mr. Speaker, under that government, there was no business cases for any new acute mental health services. We have had to build from scratch in some areas. For instance, in the East Coast, where there have not been drug and alcohol addiction rehabilitation beds, we are starting from scratch. So the member may like to reflect on her own time in office as to why we have had to do that.
Is she satisfied with the implementation of her $1.9 billion mental health announcement from Budget 2019 when only 0.2% of the funding for new facilities has been spent after 2 years?
Mr. Speaker, over 200 general practice sites are delivering integrated primary mental health and addiction services. Over 520 full-time equivalents are contracted to provide services. 134,000 sessions have been delivered by new primary mental health and addiction services since our announcements. 96,000 students have access to school-based health services. 800 additional Māori and Pacific cultural competency workforce training places every year. 1,400 plus people are supported by Te Ara Oranga, the meth harm reduction program. 74 Māori and 18 Pacific suicide prevention initiatives have been funded. We've announced, as I said, the expansion of Mana Ake into five new DHBs. And, Mr. Speaker, yes, we have put $200 million in for new and existing mental health and addiction facilities, which we continue to work through rolling out and building that capability.
Who is responsible for the failure to deliver on the $1.9 billion committed by mental health in Budget 2019 that has seen only 0.2% of the funding spent?
Mr. Speaker, I completely reject the premise of that question.
Supplementary. Is the review into mental health funding just announced an admission of her government's failure to deliver on the mental health promises of 2019?
Mr. Speaker, no. And I say again, in 2019, we announced $1.9 billion across mental health, addiction services and homelessness. 10,000 sessions of care are being provided every month. We're rolling out into schools. We're funding support for our young people. We're providing CBT training that never used to exist. So, Mr. Speaker, I totally reject the member's suggestion that nothing has happened in this space. It is, but it takes time to build from nothing.
Supplementary. Is it fair to make tradespeople, farmers, or large families even pay to subsidise someone who can afford a brand new $70,000 Tesla Model 3?
Mr. Speaker, actually on that, as the member will have heard me say earlier in one of my answers, in fact, one of our designs around the scheme we have means that we're not just creating incentives around EVs and hybrids, but low emissions vehicles. And that means 8 out of 10 of the most popular vehicles that are purchased in the second-hand market in New Zealand either attract no fee or attract a discount. So in our mindset is supporting New Zealanders to have options around vehicles that are often already popular.
Does she agree with her Minister of Revenue that, quote, we've made commitments that we're not making new taxes this term, end quote? If so, how is a $3,000 tax on a Toyota Hilux not a tax?
Mr. Speaker, the member well knows that, of course, that if you're able to legitimately avoid paying a fee by making a different choice, and, for instance, you've got an incentives regime attached, that is not the common definition of a tax. And, Mr. Speaker, what I would also say is that on that side of the House, based on what I've seen, according to at least Chris Bishop, National is meant to be the party of electric vehicles. Yeah. If the member is now proposing that they do not wish to have a fee regime attached, then that's $1 billion, $1 billion over 10 years to fund an incentives regime if it does not have a fee regime attached. I'd like to know how the National Party would pay for that.
Question number 5, Anahila Kanongatara Sirisawiki.
Kia ora e te mana whakawā. He pātai ki te...
A question to the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries.
Of the marine environment.
Mr. Speaker, this morning Dr. Aisha Verrill, as Minister of Conservation, and I launched the government's plan to revitalise the Hauraki Gulf. This delivers on an election promise. The Hauraki Gulf is our busiest marine environment. It includes the Auckland port and its beaches. It's popular for boating and fishing. It's home to an important inshore fishery and aquaculture, as well as a vast array of biodiversity. Human activity, both on land and at sea, has placed pressure on the Gulf, and we need to take action to ensure it can be enjoyed by current and future generations. The strategy's actions will work alongside the essential water program in respect of sediment issues. Sustained action in the Gulf is necessary to ensure that its environmental, cultural and economic benefits can continue to be enjoyed by future generations.
What supplementary question?
Plan to revitalise the Hauraki Gulf include?
Mr. Speaker, the package includes a fisheries plan with some 50 initiatives, including a range of changes to commercial and recreational fishing practices and catch settings. Bottom trawling is being restricted to carefully selected corridors. 18 new marine protected areas are to be created as part of the framework to support the active restoration of some of the most biodiverse regions in the Gulf. The 18 new protected areas will increase marine protection in the Gulf almost threefold. Better monitoring will improve our understanding of the marine environment and track progress over time. We're also working with mana whenua and local communities on local area coastal management in respect of local depletion issues. Promoting a prosperous, sustainable aquaculture industry will also help clean up the water. We thank all of the many thousands of Aucklanders and people around the Gulf for their efforts to bring forward the sea change plans and the Ministerial Advisory Committee that helped us get it to the shape in which we've landed.
Pātai tāpiri, what
supplementary question
to oceans and fisheries management?
Mr. Speaker, the 2016 report on behalf of the prior National Government by Mike Herron QC into Operations Achilles and Hippocamp showed significant discarding and high grading of fish. We'll never know the exact quantity of what's been happening, but it has been material. As a consequence, last week we made two significant announcements to remedy the problem. The first is for 300 inshore commercial fishing vessels to be fitted with onboard cameras. This delivers on another of the government's election commitments. Onboard cameras will provide independent, accurate information about commercial fishing activity. This will provide greater certainty and transparency, more evidence on which to base decisions about policy and regulation, scientific research, fisheries and protected species management. The rollout will be staged to prioritise those vessels that pose the greatest risk to protected species, such as Hector's dolphins, black petrels and Antipodean albatross. When complete, cameras will record activity on vessels responsible for about 85% of the commercial inshore catch by volume.
Pātai Tāpiri, what fisheries
supplementary question
changing as a consequence of installing cameras on boats?
Mr Speaker, this is part of a wider program where we're clamping down on discards and high grading. In general, from when these rules come into effect, a fin fish, if caught commercially, will have to be landed. This will incentivise fishers to innovate and move to more selective fishing practices in order to catch only the fish they want and to find ways to avoid catching the smaller or economically lower value fish if they don't want to catch them. The changes include simplifying the rules around which fish must be landed. Some of the rules are very complex for the commercial fishing sector to comply with currently. As a consequence of the greater transparency and more simplicity of rules, we are able to move to a more graduated set of penalties that better reflect the scale of offending. Sometimes those penalties are a bit over the top for minor offending at the moment. This is part of wider work that we're doing with industry leaders to improve the outcomes for everyone, and I was gratified to see that there's been considerable support from not just environmentalists but also significant parts of the industry for the measures that we're taking.
Question number six. Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, does he stand by his statement on 17 November 2020, when vaccines come to the market, we will be at the front of the queue for those, and is he satisfied with New Zealand's COVID-19 vaccine rollout?
The Honourable Dr Aisha Vera.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of COVID-19 response, yes. The New Zealand Government negotiated advance purchase agreements which gave us choices, assuring us access to four different vaccines against COVID-19. We chose a Pfizer-based strategy. Now, there are a range of effective COVID-19 vaccines in use around the world, and our vaccine rollout uses the one that has routinely received the highest efficacy estimates in the world, and it has an excellent safety profile. We have secured 10 million doses, and our rollout has seen low wastage of the vaccine and, importantly, high uptake of second doses. And although the Pfizer vaccine poses challenges, such as the need for storage at ultra-low temperatures, we have worked through that in our rollout. So we are rolling out this program while maintaining border and public health protections that keep New Zealanders safe. And as a result, we have seen zero community cases for more than 100 days. I have confidence in our COVID-19 vaccine rollout.
Has she been advised as to how many people have had their second doses of the Pfizer vaccine delayed beyond the recommended 3 weeks, in some cases up to 8 weeks?
I'm just going to remind the member, he's asking the Minister, not the Associate Minister, but go anyway.
Mr Speaker, no, I do not have access to that information, but if the member wants to put a request in writing, I'd happily provide it to him.
Has the Minister been advised as to how many vaccination clinics, the opening of vaccination clinics, have been delayed or put on hold due to a lack of vaccine supply?
Mr Speaker, no, but the DHBs continue to track according to the targets that we have set them, and that is the main metric to which we are gauging the rollout, according to.
Why is the government not able to release how many people each DHB has vaccinated in each of the four groups, or even how many people are in each group at a DHB level?
Mr. Speaker, because the criteria for the groups aren't necessarily things that government has data sets on. So, no, that's true. I mean, for example, there is not necessarily a register of everyone who meets the conditions for criteria for having a chronic condition. And so that rests on the work to make those targets rests on estimates so there is not a register of that at the DHB level.
Will every resident living in an aged care facility who wants a COVID-19 vaccine get at least their first dose of the vaccine before the end of this month, as Dr. Bloomfield said last week would be the case?
I'm not aware of anything that has changed since then, but I think the important thing is that the final dose of vaccine for people in aged residential care will be offered by the end of July.
Why are MPs around the Parliament being contacted by people in Group 3 with underlying health conditions who have not been contacted by their DHB and who ring their GP or their DHB who tell them they have no idea when they will be vaccinated?
People in Group 3 include over 1.5 million people, and they will be invited to have a vaccine, given their booking appointment, by the end of July.
Question number 7, Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Education and asks, what recent progress has she seen on providing barrier-free access to education?
Mr. Speaker, last week I saw the first free period products being delivered into schools as part of the government's nationwide rollout. So far, over 86,000 pads and tampons have been received by schools. Free period products are part of a wider effort to combat child poverty, help increase school attendance and make a positive impact on student wellbeing. It follows other barrier-free access initiatives rolled out by this government, including free healthy lunches in school, counsellors in schools, removing school donations and Manaaki mental health and wellbeing services.
Supplementary, what feedback has she received on the impact this program will have?
Mr. Speaker, I have spoken to many young women and girls in schools who have told me firsthand the differences this will make in their lives. One young girl last week in Auckland Girls Grammar shared a story of how it will make a difference to her and her single parent father. The free period products will not only reduce financial stress on their household, but will improve her participation and comfort in school life.
Supplementary. What are the next steps in this program?
Mr. Speaker, the subsequent phases of this program will include refining the distribution model so we can further improve the allocation of products where and when they are needed. This will be informed by student voice, and the aim is to be as flexible to the needs and preferences as possible. An important part of this rollout, Mr. Speaker, is the program that will involve developing educational resources to support the education, to reduce stigma, and include our young, to help our young people's comfort in talking and dealing with their periods at school for both our male and our female students.
Question number 8, Matt Doocy.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Health and asks, why, as of the end of April 2021, has only 0.2% of the $235 million announced in Budget 2019 for capital investment in mental health and addiction facilities actually been spent?
Mr. Speaker, the $235 million was set aside for the investment into rebuilding or upgrading mental health facilities from the total vote health allocation of $1.1 billion for the mental health services upgrade. Health capital projects follow a detailed process which takes time. This includes prioritisation, business case development and design work all before building can start. For example, the original announcement for the full rebuild of the Henry Rongomo Bennett Centre in Waikato said the facility would open in 2023. In relation to what the member says has been spent, the member should be aware there is a timing difference between what is spent by district health boards on a capital project and what is claimed from the Ministry of Health and booked against the relevant appropriation. Claims for expenses incurred for capital projects are made at relevant milestones, for example, once the detailed business case and allocated funding has been approved, or at relevant times during the financial year. Of the five projects funded from the $235 million allocation, four are in the detailed design phase and one is still awaiting a business case. All are incurring expenditure right now, but only two have sought minimal reimbursement for preliminary work.
Why did the Ministry of Health mislead the media yesterday when it stated they couldn't say how much had been spent on building...
A point of order, the Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, I'm not sure. I think there are various speakers' rulings about using the phrasing that the member did in that question. I'm not sure that's within standing orders.
Order. Who interjected then? The member will withdraw and apologise.
Apologise.
And I'll reverse out the decision I made earlier. Speaking to that point of order?
Well, the reason I'm able to put that primary question is because I received from the Ministry of Health how much they actually spent, yet yesterday they told the media, when asked the same question, they didn't know how much. I'd call that misleading.
Speaking for further point.
The point is that it was made as a direct assertion. Mr Ducey's provided us with some information which may or may not be correct. We can't see that, and I don't think it's with...
Who was that?
It's a repeat offender, Mr. Speaker.
Who was it? Who made that noise?
I did.
The member will leave the chamber. Matt Ducey.
Would it be helpful if I slightly rephrase the question, might get through with your permission? Can I give it a go?
The member can give it a go. I was tending in his direction anyway, but have a go.
That's okay. Here to help. It's been a tough day for you guys.
So the answer is now no. So if the member wants to use another supplementary, he can.
Why has only one new mental health facility opened since Labor came into government almost 4 years ago?
Mr Speaker, there's a very good reason for that, and that is that apart from one facility that the previous government approved in 2015 and that opened last year, that government did absolutely nothing for mental health services in New Zealand. They left the mental health services in this country in an absolutely parlous state, which is why as soon as we took office, we did a stock take, we had a review, and we developed a plan, a $1.9 billion plan, that is a 4 to 5 year plan, and we are partway through implementing that with all the benefits that the Prime Minister has already articulated. But we are doing a plan. It is good, it is making a difference, and it is the right thing to do for vulnerable New Zealanders.
Supplementary. What was the point of the last mental health review initiated by the government in 2018 if we now need to have another review announced this morning?
Mr Speaker, the reason we had the review in 2018 is because the previous government left mental health services in an absolutely parlous state. They just totally ignored the emerging mental health crisis in this country. They washed their hands of it. And the sad reality is that, as typically happens, Labor governments end up picking up the pieces. But the pieces when a government neglects mental health are the shattered lives of vulnerable New Zealanders who we are now desperately having to repair a broken system for, so they get the treatment and care that they deserve.
Supplementary. How can New Zealanders trust the government's review into mental health announced by him this morning when his government's failure to deliver in mental health is the problem?
Mr Speaker, I'm happy to go through what this government has done in the 2 years since the announcement of the $1.9 billion upgrade, 520 full-time equivalent roles now added to our mental health services, 360 health improvement practitioners and health coaches and GP practices, 50 in Māori, Kaupapa Māori Health Services, 50 in Pacific Mental Health Services, and another several dozen in our youth mental health services. So we have added considerably to it. We've made the commitment to significantly upgrade or rebuild five mental health facilities because they were left in a state of neglect by the previous government. We have done more in mental health in the last 3.5 years than was done in 9 years of that previous national government.
Question number 9, the Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries, why has the government's response to the sea change Taitimu, Taipai, Taipari, Hauraki Gulf Marine Spatial Plan not implemented the Hauraki Gulf Forum target of protecting 30% of the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park, Te Kapa Moana, Te Mananui, Atoi?
Speaker. The government's plan to revitalise the Hauraki Gulf announced today includes just under a threefold increase in marine protected areas, plus a significant reduction in the areas open to bottom trawling and Danish seine fishing, plus restrictions on scallop dredging, plus habitat restoration. All of these actions are supported by a cross-agency implementation plan with a new monitoring and reporting approach to enable changes to the strategy if we're not satisfied with progress. I note the Hauraki Gulf Forum today welcomed the government's announcement, calling it, quotes, an important first step towards the desired 30% of marine area protection. Today's announcement, in my view, is a milestone that ought not to be understated.
Were the potential impacts on commercial fishing the major reason for fully protecting only 5% of the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park?
No.
Why is the government proposing to delay legislation to establish the proposed new marine protected areas until 2024?
That, I think, is the date for completion of legislation. There are some preliminary steps that we are required to go through before introducing legislation, and then we'll take its ordinary course. I would note that the process that's being proposed is just about identical to that which the member was promoting when she was herself the Minister of Conservation. I don't think a lot has changed since, and I thank her for her good efforts back then.
What scientific research and modelling supports the government's decision to allow bottom trawling to continue in some areas against the sea change plan recommendation that the government exclude activities such as dredging and bottom trawling from the Gulf by 2025?
Mr Speaker, there's significant changes being made here. Already bottom trawling's banned on all of the inner part of the Gulf. There are extensions to some of the seining methods, and as I've already explained, future bottom trawling will be limited to corridors. Those will be chosen on the basis of minimising damage to benthic environments, in other words, protecting the most important benthic environments from bottom trawling. We think that this will make significant progress. It will also enable us, through the monitoring regime, to assess the longer-term outcomes of the sites relative to each other. If we've got limited corridors for bottom trawling, we will be able to carry out some in-depth science as to what is the effect of bottom trawling in the areas in which it remains compared with the environmental outcomes in other areas.
Why does the government's strategy exclude protection of the waters around the Noises Islands, Otatata, Ruapoke and David Rocks, even though the Otatata owners, research organisations such as Auckland Museum and others have actively sought the protection of those waters?
That protection hasn't been ruled out, but it hasn't been landed yet, and work is continuing on those issues.
Will Minister commit to further work to establish marine protected areas over at least 30% of the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park in this term of government? If not, why not?
I'm very suspicious of people who call for us to effectively halt and go back again and have another talk about what we might do. I'd rather get on and do what we're doing. I really do think we should not understate the significance of what's been announced today.
Question number 10, Angela Roberts.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Transport. What recent announcements has he made about increasing the uptake of low emissions vehicles?
The Honourable Michael Woods.
Mr. Speaker, recently myself and the Honourable James Shaw announced our clean car package to help drive down emissions. This builds on our previous announcements of decarbonising the public transport bus fleet, revitalising rail and our clean car import standard. We're supporting the uptake of zero and low emission vehicles by making sure that electric vehicle charges are now available every 75 kilometres along most of the state highway network, nearly quadrupling the low emission transport fund to grow the nationwide EV charging network, setting up a clean car sector leadership group, bringing in a sustainable biofuels mandate to prevent over a million tonnes of emissions, and implementing a clean car discount to help get more Kiwis into clean cars at a lower price.
Is decarbonising the transport sector a focus for the government?
Mr. Speaker, tackling climate change is a real priority for this government. The transport sector currently produces 47% of New Zealand's CO2 emissions, and between 1990 and 2018, domestic transport emissions increased by 90%. Reaching New Zealand's goal of net zero carbon by 2050 will unclog our cities, clean up our air, support the creation of new businesses and low carbon industries, and create sustainable jobs around our country. Now is the time for New Zealand to move ahead with the transition like the rest of the world is.
What reaction has he seen to the announcement?
Mr. Speaker, the announcement has been very warmly welcomed across New Zealand and by the industry. The Motor Industry Association Chief Executive David Crawford said he was delighted, and New Zealand Energy Solutions
order,
business Vector...
Order. I'm going to ask the Deputy Prime Minister to stop inciting a riot.
Mr. Speaker, as I was just saying, the Motor Industry Association Chief Executive David Crawford said he was delighted, and New Zealand Energy Solutions business Vector welcomed our announcement. The AA Policy and Research Manager Simon Douglas said reducing emissions from transport is going to take a mix of actions for new vehicles, used vehicles and the fuels that vehicles already on our roads run on, and this package from the government takes good steps on all fronts.
Question number 11, Christopher Luxton.
Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Transport and reads, does he stand by all his statements and actions?
The Honourable Michael.
Mr. Speaker, yes. In particular, our government's maintaining international air connectivity scheme, which has helped keep trade channels open and maintain supply of time-critical goods like medicines into New Zealand. Since May last year, government support has enabled more than 7,000 flights carrying over 136,000 tonnes of air freight, helping our economic recovery, and I can confirm there were no weapons for the Saudis on any of those flights.
How does $785 million for the proposed Northern Pathway cycle bridge represent a better use of money than a new Ashburton bridge or fixing one of New Zealand's deadliest roads from Tapuna to Omokarara?
Mr. Speaker, as the member will be aware, the government makes a range of initiatives across our transport system. And in the recently announced New Zealand Upgrade Package, $8.9 billion of investment will be made across road, rail and walking and cycling initiatives. This government does believe that if we want good transport outcomes for all New Zealanders, that we have to invest across all of those modes. Unlike the previous government, we don't believe that a four-lane motorway is a solution to every transport problem.
How would the proposed $785 million Northern Pathway cycle bridge shorten commutes for tradies stuck in gridlock and help older Aucklanders get to their appointments on time?
Mr. Speaker, the member for an intelligent member in his question displays an incredible immaturity in terms of how,
policy... Order, the member will resume his seat. That is not an appropriate way to start... I've got little hair to tear out, but when I'm trying to assist the members in getting the minister to answer in an appropriate way, their support is counterproductive. The minister will withdraw and apologise and start his answer again.
I withdraw and apologise. Mr. Speaker, a transport policy that supports good outcomes for everyone will actually bring together different modes. And so just saying, does a particular transport project in a particular part of the city affect an individual is not the way to develop an integrated transport policy. What we need to do in our congested cities is actually turn around the failed policies of the past, where all we're focused on has been building roads. That is what has got us into the current mess that we're in, and if we continue doing it, we will get the same outcomes. That is why this government does have a policy of investing across the modes, including road, including rail, and including walking and cycling. And the message for people who are stuck on those roads is that every single person on Auckland Roads, Wellington Roads, Christchurch Roads or around the country, that we get onto public transport, that we get onto walking and cycling, is one less person congesting the road that tradie is stuck on.
Not rocket science.
Will the estimated 3,000 daily users of the $785 million Northern Pathways cycleway seriously drive transport mode shift for a city of 1.7 million people?
Well, Mr Speaker, firstly, the member has used a statistic which is 40% below the estimate that has in fact been provided by Waka Kotahi. But the key point that I wish to make, Mr Speaker, is that solving the transport problems that we have in New Zealand that have built up over many decades will take a range of investments. So in terms of the New Zealand upgrade package, of which the Northern Pathway is one point, we have $2.5 billion of investments in South Auckland as well, including investments in State Highway 1,
The member's answered the question.
Can he guarantee that the $785 million cost will not be increased further in light of the 20-fold increase in costs since Labor candidate Michael Wood announced in 2017 that the Skypath project would cost $30 million?
Oh, Mr Speaker, I can give the member confidence in the robustness of the figures that have been produced. But Mr Speaker, the member might like to talk to some others about the long history of transport projects in this country, including the roads of national significance, which required an additional $2.5 billion of investment to be delivered under that previous government.
That concludes oral questions. Sorry?
Question 12.
I apologise. I was just sort of looking forward to getting on to the next business.
Tēnā koe te mana whakaua. He pātai tēnei. To the Minister, the Associate Minister of Statistics, how is she ensuring that Stats New Zealand increases the data capability and capacity of iwi Māori?
The Honourable Mecca Whaitere.
Speaker, I am working with Stats New Zealand to support the growth of iwi Māori data capability and capacity by ensuring that the department works collaboratively in a community-led manner to design and test engagement activities aimed at increasing participation within specified communities. By developing an approach to enable iwi-led collection and analysis of census data, and by co-designing products and services that will be of value to Māori using Census 223 data. We're also working with iwi Māori, including the co-design of a Māori data governance model to develop in an approach to data governance that reflects Māori needs and interests. Why? Because what's good for Māori is good for all.
Supplementary. How is Budget 2021 helping to increase iwi Māori data capability and capacity?
Mr Speaker, Budget 2021 continues this commitment towards iwi Māori data capability and capacity building, with a particular focus on Census 2023. 14.08 million secured in Budget 2021 will enable Stats New Zealand, in partnership with iwi Māori, to collect census data in two geographical areas of approximately 10,000 dwellings each. This will ensure capability and capacity is built in two key areas, data collection and data analytics. This approach is an important pilot that will help to strengthen enduring ways for the Crown and iwi to work together on co-design and delivering together. Delivering with Māori means delivering for all.
What data announcements has the Minister seen in relation to partnership with iwi Māori?
Mr Speaker, today Stats New Zealand and Data iwi Leaders Group have jointly released the 2018 iwi affiliation estimated counts to help fill gaps that currently exist within the data system for iwi. under the Mana Oriti relationship agreement signed between Stats New Zealand and the Data Iwi Leaders Group of the National Iwi Chairs Forum, we're aspiring towards systemic changes to ensure that Iwi Māori have equitable access and responsibility in relation to the data system. Alongside this mahi, and with the support of Stats New Zealand, the Data Iwi Leaders Group have created the data platform Te Whata, an online storehouse of data designed to make iwi data more relevant, accessible and useful to iwi.
That concludes our questions.